Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another show. Today, I have Ken O'Keefe with me, previous Marines combat veteran in the United States. Ken, welcome to the show.
God bless you, Mahmoud. I've been listening to your stuff for a long time, and I love your analysis. You have the Palestinian Arabic Islamic understanding, and you see things that Western commentators don't really understand unless they've at least, you know, lived there and had some time there and know a thing or two. So it's a blessing to be here, brother, and really thank God for all the good work you're doing. I absolutely adore your analysis. It's just incredible analyzing of what's really happening. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated. And I'm also a big fan of your work as well. I've been seeing many of your videos, went back in time. Today, hopefully, we'll go back to those days. You've been an activist. You've been anti-war. You tried to stop the war in Iraq. You were campaigning for Gaza. And at the time, it was very, very difficult. It was as if you were going against the world. Now, we have social media. People can see other people participating. And it must have been very difficult for you at the time, which we will reach in a second. But if you wouldn't mind, for our viewers who don't know Ken O'Keefe, how did it start, especially from your early days moving to the U.S. Marines and then, of course, your anti-war activism? How did it all begin?
You know, I love irony. The way it started for me was I had no intention of joining the military. I really didn't. I was living in San Diego. I was a waiter in a French, high-end French restaurant. I was making great money. I'd moved out of my mom's place at 18 right away, and I was living in Encinitas, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. You know, I was just living the life, man. I was really great car, everything. But I ended up, Blockbuster was around those days, and me and my best friend went out, and Full Metal Jacket had just come out, and I was like, yeah, I want to see, we both wanted to see it. So we got Full Metal Jacket. Stanley Kubrick, a Jew, my favorite Jewish producer, director of all time, love Stanley. Anyway, we're watching Full Metal Jacket. And for those who haven't seen the movie, I'm telling you, it's like a documentary. The first half of that movie is Marine Corps boot camp. And it's shot in Paris Island, which is where they do boot camp. And even the actors had to do like a month mini boot camp to learn how to march and to do all the things that Marines do. And it was like watching that I just realized, like, that's what I need. You know, I wanted to become a man, like, you know, like I had no plan. And I told my friend, I was like, I'm going to sign up. He didn't believe me. And within 2 weeks I had enlisted. And I put in my notice, and they were all shocked because this job, like the maitre d' of the restaurant that I worked at when I was 18, 19 years old, he's still working at that place as the food and beverage director for the larger resort now. So this was the kind of job that people didn't leave. Like, and I didn't even get the job the first time. They like pulled me in for a second interview. Anyway, I joined the Marine Corps to become a man. And I didn't join the Air Force. I didn't join the Navy, man. I didn't even just join the Marines. Infantry, grunt, man. That's what I want. So I signed up and I go to boot camp and no problem. Pass that, do well. I hit the high marks on every level, like rifle expert, third award every time, the highest award you could get. I had a perfect physical fitness test 1 year, which is damn near impossible to get. And I was so damn good at what I did that I was the only junior Marine who was made an assistant team leader in a four-person fire team and as a machine gunner. So I carried like the Rambo gun, which is a big responsibility in the infantry. And anyway, things are going good, man. I made it up to Lance Corporal. But what happened to me was the classic. We got an order. And that order was not a lawful order. And when we take an oath, I remember when I took that oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, to fight all enemies, foreign and domestic, to bear true faith and allegiance to the same, to follow the orders of the officers appointed over me and the President of the United States, according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, so help me God. The Uniform Code of Military Justice makes very clear that if you are given an unlawful order, your duty is to disobey that order. And furthermore, if you were given an order, say, for instance, like the Israelis, like executing prisoners of war, if you had a commander who gave you that order, then your duty would actually be to then take your weapon and put it on your superior and put him under arrest for giving that. That's the truth of the matter. That is the truth. So the bottom line is, I'm like the best Marine. I'm in the highest position of authority, and we got an unlawful order, and everybody followed it and was bitching and moaning about it. And I was the guy who was like, no, I did not sign up to just follow orders. I signed up for leadership by example, for honor, integrity, to be a man. And I did not follow just to follow orders, any old orders. So I jumped my chain of command, cardinal sin. Because if I'd went to my command, they were the ones doing it. They would have just said, get out of our face. And they would have made my life hell for even going to them. Bottom line is, I jumped the chain of command. I put it in writing what they did. The chief on the ship then read them the riot act. And they wanted to know who the hell it was. And honor and integrity, right? So when my squad leader came back after getting read the riot act, like, somebody did this. Find out who it is. He had no idea. And I remember he said, anybody know who did this? And I was like, yeah, I did it. And he looked at me like, oh. Because he knew, like, I am in a world of, I'll spare the word, but in the movie, a world of, you can do the rest. And so he went and told my platoon sergeant, and then he said, bring him here. And he came to me. He's like, follow me. And there's a reason. I'm telling you the context of the story because it's all very relevant. So he comes to me and he's like, follow me. And I have this knack for doing stuff. Like, when I'm really in, like, putting myself in a crazy, dangerous position, I always just kind of end up laughing to myself. And I'm following him, and we're going, like, down into the bowels of the ship, like, deeper, another level. And I'm just like, oh my God, the staff NCOs are all going to be in there waiting. These are like hardcore enlisted Marines, right? 15 years, 20 years, Vietnam vets, Korea veterans, and all this kind of stuff. And he takes me down and down and down and down. And there's my platoon sergeant. He's alone, which is kind of a bit of a relief. And I'm reporting for duty, reporting his order. And he looked at me, and I'll leave the one word out, but he just looked at me. He looked up at me. We're sitting down, and he looked up at me with this scowl on his face. And he said, my name was Nichols at the time. My name is Kenneth Nichols O'Keefe now, and it's a legal name change and whatever, blah, blah, blah. I am an O'Keefe. But anyway, he said to me, Nichols, in my 17 years in the Marine Corps, you're the biggest piece of SHIT. and I'm going to fry your ass first chance I get. He was not joking, boy. And I'm telling you, if anybody out there has ever had a horrible boss, like an evil boss, like you hated this guy, now amplify that about 1,000 times, because in the Marine Corps infantry, and I ended up going off to a war. I went off to a war, like, and this guy hates me, and he said he's going to fry me first chance he get. I ended up going from Lance Corporal back down to PFC, and then from PFC down to private. I did time in the brig. I got confined to barracks. I lost wages. So I had 2 years of this, and I went off to a war. So the reason why I tell that whole story is because by the time I got out of the Marine Corps, after 2 years, the beauty of this was, all that indoctrination, like America's the greatest, yeah, rah, rah, all that stuff, that was gone now. You got me to believe that the Marine Corps, the few, the proud, the Marines, you know, and you lied to me. And if I'm wrong about the Marine Corps, what else am I wrong about? What else am I wrong about? So there were two things that happened to me from that experience. And again, I had 2 years to soak that up. So it wasn't like I was going to forget next week. This is with me for life now. Two things I committed to when I got out of the Marine Corps. One, you were wrong about the Marine Corps. You were a chump. You were a mercenary for the banksters. You were cannon fodder, and what I would come down to realize later on, for the Greater Israel Project, because I went to Iraq, which was target number one, the first Gulf War. And we decimated Iraq and killed hundreds of thousands, millions actually, from all the infrastructure we bombed and everything like that. So when I got out of the Marine Corps, there were two things. Truth. You were wrong about the Marine Corps. Truth became God to me, and truth is God. Truth is God, and God is truth. They are one and the same. And the other thing was my freedom. I had signed away my freedom. I was literally government property, like literally government property. I was injected with experimental drugs that killed many from Gulf War syndrome. That's from them doing their COVID stuff. Yeah, way back. So I'm a human guinea pig. You say that Adolf Hitler did that. First off, that's a lie. Mm. But secondly, even if he did, George Bush Sr. did it to me and 600,000 others. And by the way, only the Brits and the Yanks are the ones who got Gulf War syndrome. And guess who are the only ones who got those death jabs? Oh, the Brits and the Yanks. The French didn't take them. None of the other coalition of the willing. So anyway, I committed.
Can we stop here for 1 second, if I may? I'm sorry to interrupt you, and I'll let you have the full story afterwards. What did they give you exactly? And can you tell the viewers about the syndrome? What was it exactly? What happened?
So this even makes it better. Part of the reason why I knew decades ago that Saddam Hussein had a chemical and biological and arguably even like radioactive materials, biological weapons and chemical weapons was because, well, we gave them to him. Remember now, you know this. I know you know this because Saddam Hussein was our best little buddy. He was our little attack dog in the Middle East. And his first job was Iran, Sikkim. And I've been to Iran several times. So I've met veterans in Iran who still have respiratory issues and skin diseases from the chemical weapons, including mustard gas, and they used anthrax and other stuff like this. So Iraq had already used that on Iran. Iran lost about 1 million people in that. Young ones were like lying about their age so they could go to the front and fight. They fought a noble war of defense, and they paid a heavy price because of the chemical weapons that were used. So when we went to the Gulf War, the military had to help protect us from the chemical weapons that we gave to Saddam. So here's a bunch of injections and pills. Here, we're going to give you a bunch of injections and pills to protect you from the chemical and biological weapons that we gave Saddam when he was only killing those Iranians, the Persians. But now, and then, of course, I didn't know enough at that point. I was still very stupid. And ultimately, we all took it, but many died. It's one is PTSYD, it's pure cytidrin, whatever. It's some big, long thing, and it's proven. But also, we took botulism, anthrax. We took nerve agent pills, and were injected, like, several injections.
Wow.
And anyway, I believe that I had a miraculous, well, God has been with me, really, the whole time. But after the Marine Corps, I ended up becoming an animal rights activist and an environmentalist, and I was a vegan, and I've been doing natural healing my whole life. So through fasting and good diet, I believe I got all that crap out of me. But others died, and the rates for birth defects went up for American military. The rates of miscarriages went up for the wives. And many died, and they covered it all up. Nobody even really knows what it is. There you go. Who owns the media? Oh, we all know who owns the media.
Unbelievable. So anyway, wow.
Yeah, so by the grace of God, all these things sort of added up. And you know, of course, what I love about the Marine Corps more than anything is I just didn't like being a chump. You were a chump, Ken. And you know, and I if anybody says, oh, you didn't know, people normally do that kind of stuff. I'm like, dude, I don't like sugarcoating. I was an idiot. So here, and that's what everybody needs to do right now, especially the Americans, but all the Europeans, all of you that were brainwashed, and Israel has a right to defend itself. You were an idiot. You were an idiot. You were manipulated. And you need to be a humble. You need to be humble because a weak man doesn't have the integrity to admit I was wrong. A strong man will acknowledge when he has been wrong. But little beta male cucks don't know how to acknowledge when they were wrong. And these are the kind of people you see on the keyboard warriors and stuff, little cowards. And, you know, so anyway, the bottom line is I'm so grateful for all of it. I've said this publicly many times, like I was an idiot and I didn't like being an idiot, and neither should anybody else.
Interesting. Very interesting. And I mean, I think your experience really represents how many Americans go into the army. It started with propaganda. You saw it in the movies. They play it in the video games. And then they go and actually implement it in real life. And it takes some guts, I have to give it to you, to go and, you know, challenge your superiors in the Marines to go against an unlawful, like you said, unlawful order. So then after that, you started to become a human and animal rights activist, then human rights activist. Then you started to have these famous interviews afterwards when you were opposing the war. But before we go into the second Gulf War or the Iraq invasion in 2003, let's go back to 2001. 9/11, the biggest pretext in the world, of course, to carry out the century of war, the biggest false flag of the 21st century. What did you think about it at the time?
Well, I'll tell you what, let me just throw in a little extra context, because another thing that, by the grace of God, I moved from California to Hawaii to become a dive instructor. So I had a business. It was rated number one in the entire state. And I personally rescued 46 green sea turtles that were wrapped in fishing line.
Wow.
I did 13 ghost net recoveries. Animal Planet did a story about us. BBC did a story, 100 plus news stories in the local news. I have all that stuff. So I was doing that. But while I was living in Hawaii, I realized, like, dude, you're just another Howley who doesn't even know anything about the history nor the culture, regardless of the good work I was doing as a dive instructor. So I made a decision to learn, like a good guest does in someone else's home. And so by the grace of God, I connected directly with the Kingdom of Hawaii. And I ended up going to these meetings. I was like the only white boy, and all the Kanaka Maolis, the Hawaiians, what the hell is this white boy doing here? Like, what the hell is he doing here? And so I proved over a long period of time, and like they eventually started to realize, like, no, he's a real one. And I became a Hawaiian national, and I became well versed in Hawaiian history and the genocide. That word genocide, I already had a highly developed understanding of that word and international law, which I learned about the Hawaiian Kingdom, the Law of Nations, Vattel, written in the 1700s, which is sort of where we see the origins of what we now call international law. And so I studied the Law of Nations. I studied Hawaiian Kingdom law. I've studied constitutional law. I studied Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights in the UK and the Constitution there. I studied law, and I had a great understanding of law, and I've quoted genocide way before. Remember how long we had to sit there? Oh, it's not a it is a genocide. When you call people human animals, and then you refer to Amalek, and then you turn off the electricity, that's genocide, because I know the Black's Law Dictionary definition, and I've been saying it forever, to destroy in whole or part a national, ethnic, or religious group. There you go. To destroy in whole or part a national, ethnic, or religious group. So I am a Hawaiian Kingdom national. I have Hawaiian nationality. Wikipedia doesn't want to recognize that, but I, you know, as you know, I have Palestinian citizenship as well. But I was already dialed in. I was a dive instructor. I was living on the beach in Hawaii. I was making money. I was in top shape, tanned, blonde, just, you know, having a good time, let's say. And I've now earned the respect of the Hawaiians as well. So I'm not just another Howley. I'm actually a guy who cares about Hawaii. And so 9/11 rolls around, getting back to your question. I'm already dialed in, man. I know false flags. I know all this stuff. And because Hawaii's time zone is about, say, 6-7 hours behind the East Coast. So when the planes or the holograms or whatever the hell it is, whatever hit those things, when that was happening, somebody called up, like it was, you know, the middle of the night. And they were like, they called. I'm like, yeah, what's up? And he said, turn on the TV. So I had an Iranian. I made friends with an Iranian because most Americans are just stupid about geopolitics. But an Iranian guy, he knew. And it was like, I said, hey, man, if you want a place, I'll put you up. So he was living in my place. And so I've got an Iranian in my place. And I've already made enemies of the United States. I had run-ins with the police. I have transcripts. I had an $11,000 bench warrant issued for my arrest for a minor traffic violation that I can prove. Anyway, whatever. We'd be here for days if I got into all of it. But the bottom line is, I already had a warrant issued for my arrest. So I'm like the president of my own company, rated number one. One of my contracts is the Turtle Bay Hilton. And I'm going to pick up my customers, and I've got a warrant for my arrest for $11,000. Like, literally. So when 9/11 happened, I just knew right away, like, oh God. And you know, so they were saying the hijackers, and then we have the passports and like all this, and I'm looking at this, and I knew immediately, like, all the Americans were buying this hook, line, and sinker, and I knew it was absolute rubbish. And I knew it was going to be some disaster war path. And I knew it so quick. I was like, that day I told my friend, I was like, dude, I got to get out of Dodge. I know me. I cannot keep my mouth shut. I will not keep my mouth shut. And at that time, you know, I'm a tough guy. But if I went into a crowd of people or a pub and started saying, it wasn't, you know, that's a BS version, that's not what happened, and, you know, and it was the Jews that did it, they would have gang attacked me and like, probably pummeled me. But that wasn't the real risk. It was being framed. I knew it. They could easily just frame me, plant some drugs or maybe even some explosives, and then link me to the Hawaiians and say, you know, this was like terrorism to bring back the Hawaiian kingdom. And I went to my mom. My mom had taken an early retirement, and she ended up coming over to my business, and then we were partners. So it was beautiful. It was like a family business, living in paradise, making money, doing what I loved. And I told my mom, yeah, Mom, I got to get out of here. I got to go. And she understood, even though it broke her heart. And I literally fled the United States November 26th after 9/11. So like 2 months later, after my mom's birthday, which is November 23rd, which is coming up, I fled the country and I sought political asylum in the Netherlands. And that's a whole nother story. But I managed to get into that. I was the only American, like, political asylum seeker 2 months after 9/11. This was not what anybody nobody wanted that, not least of which the Dutch. But I thought the Dutch were very human rights respecting, so I thought that would work.
Of course.
So 9/11, nice. You know, I knew it was, you know, and it became very clear to me, and within a year I was on CNN doing interviews for Human Shields, and I said on CNN, nobody said this before me. I have the interview. I said, it was live. Even the Hard Talk interview, I would have said something about 9/11, but it was recorded. And I reckon, like, if I do too good, man, they just won't air it. So I left 9/11 out of it. Even in the second interview, I left it out of it, and I wanted to get into it. But the bottom
line
is,
I'm not surprised.
I said on CNN that the U.S. government was either directly involved or complicit with 9/11, and that was at the very end of 2002, the first day of 2003. So, like, barely a year later, I said that on CNN. I knew it. So there you go.
It was difficult to say anything at the time because of the media censorship. And it's as if all of them had the script that they needed to follow 24/7. But the interesting thing is, if you observed at the time what was happening, well, in New York, many people didn't buy it in New York from the New York citizens after the 9/11. And there were several people who were investigating the matter who disappeared. Again, people disappear when they investigate these things. I wrote several articles in Arabic back in 2008. It was fascinating to go into the details and the information and the archives of 9/11 at the time, when you start finding out that the whole story was twisted from day one, even the Bin Laden story, who denied any relation to it with two statements from Afghanistan, and then leading to the evidence, of course, the planted explosive devices, building number 7, all of that. And some people try and cover it up by saying, yeah, there are some elements, but no, it's actually not a wholly a carefully calculated and executed federal government operation. Again, they're trying to play into the narrative of the government and the federal government and their involvement. That also didn't work, and many people are questioning now. 9/11 happened. Then we come, you're faced with another war.
Can I just say one thing on that note, just a quick one? Because sure. I feel like it's the main point that people, like, I see more people finally starting to say some of these things and whatnot. By the way, a bit of a coincidence there. Charlie Kirk was murdered on September 10th, eh?
That kind of
took the whole 9/11.
Do you remember many things happening every 9/11, by the way? Do you remember? Several years after 9/11, every 9/11, something used to happen. Do you remember that? I think people forget that. Every 9/11, something used to happen. So they want to embed it in people's heads. 9/11. Unbelievable.
A bit of a coincidence there. The thing that I think people overlook so much, which is just absolute proof, is Larry Silverstein and Frank Lowy. Two Jewish billionaires who made the worst investment in the history of mankind, were it not for them all falling to dust in the next month after they bought it. Because the Port Authority of New York, those buildings had asbestos, and there was already they were half empty. They were half empty, and there was already a lawsuit for a cancer that was directly attributed to the asbestos in the building. So the precedent had already been set. The Port Authority, which we all know, and you can say whatever you want about Mondami, and maybe we'll get into that. But the bottom line is, the Jews are still running New York. I don't care what anybody thinks. And they certainly did then. And they completely run the Port Authority. And they were trying to get out because the Port Authority had legal ownership of the towers. So they wanted to get out from under it, of course, because they knew the liability. The liability was for it was estimated the cost of removing the asbestos was going to be like over $1 billion, like $2 billion or even $3 billion. So the cost of removing the asbestos was more than the value of the buildings, 100-fold more. So they ended up, now, would they not know that as two Jewish billionaire real estate tycoons directly connected to Mossad? Of course they would know that. So two Jewish billionaires decide to buy these worthless asbestos-filled buildings that transfers billions of dollars of liability to them and the responsibility to remove safely the asbestos. But lo and behold, 9/11 happens. And these buildings come down in a way that can't be explained by controlled demolition or anything like that. That is not a controlled demolition. Those buildings turned to dust, and there were holes in the ground. And I'm friends, God bless him, he's passed on, with Rudy Dent, who was the chief fire investigator for New York City, whose job it was to investigate arson scenes where it was suspected there may have been some cause. He was there, and he said famously, and he was a dear brother and friend to me, I stayed in his home, that he heard the explosions and that he saw, and he lost 444 of his brothers that day. So anyway, I charge Frank Lowy and Larry Silverstein with 9/11 with direct involvement, and they are still got their dirty little Jewish mitts all over my Burt Nation. So America, while you all start figuring out the whole making America greater thing was an absolute scam and that your president is a kid-touching pedophile, you might as well add the whole treason and those dual nationals. Those dual nationals, as long as they're still there, your country will never, ever be anything to be proud of, only to be ashamed of. So anyway, I know you, Frank Lowy and Larry Silverstein, coming for you.
So all of that happened at the time, and then of course they used it as a pretext to go and invade Afghanistan and then Iraq. All of a sudden you're met with the same scenario, but now you're outside the army. You already know the score and what's happening. How did it feel like that the United States was attacking Iraq at the time, and what steps did you take at the time? I heard you actually tried to stop, and you went to Iraq as well, and you tried to stop the war from happening. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so here's what was happening. So I fled Hawaii in my paradise life. I landed in Amsterdam. The way the law works, I had I in those 2 months I prepared, like I knew according to law I am a legitimate political asylum seeker. I am already can prove that I'm being targeted by my government because of my political activity directly attributable to my actions with the Hawaiian Kingdom, and also my insistence on honoring my oath and calling out judges and prosecutors and everybody for not honoring the oath to the Constitution. So, you know, like I had a 100-page document with exhibits that had proof that I was legit. And I got to the Netherlands. I caught them in a fraud. They were like, dude, they did not want an American refugee seeking political asylum. But bottom line is, I caught them in a fraud. I literally caught them dead to rights to try and remove the key document that proved that I was being targeted. And when I caught them, they had no choice. And so I was officially put into the asylum procedure. And I actually lived in a refugee camp in the Netherlands with like mostly Africans, but there were people from the Middle East and everything. I lived in an actual refugee. Of course, I'm the only white dude in there, like from America, no less, right? And they're all like, what are you doing here? They all wanted to go to my country, and here I am fleeing my country. And so I'm in there, and I eventually get myself a flat outside, and that's when the buildup to Iraq is coming, and I'm watching this. And I knew it was BS. I knew it was all lies. I knew it. And you know, for all the evidence is there. If people want it for real, you could have found it back then, just like me. Scott Ritter was saying stuff. He was inspecting, like they don't have anything, blah, blah, blah. But it was really personal for me, Mahmoud. It was really personal because I was in the first Gulf War. And whatever anybody wants to think about it, we killed tons of people in that war. The ground war, when it kicked off and I got my combat action, they were all either had retreated or had white flags or were dead because we had bombed them from the air, just like bombed them, leveled them. So we had one point of engagement where we took some fire, but I never had to even fire my machine gun. So I killed nobody. Thank God for that. But I was in a war where we committed war crimes and we killed tons of people, and you know, and I will be judged for all of it. So I felt that one of the most important words and things to do in life, which people really need to think about, in my opinion, is atone. Where you have sinned, where you have made a mistake, you need to be able to own up to that, acknowledge that you've made a mistake. And if you have made a mistake, then you need to do your best to atone for that mistake. Obviously, we can't go back in time. So when I was watching the invasion of Iraq and knowing the second one, and I knowing that I was involved in the first one and that I had given up my paradise life, and now I'm watching my birth nation lead the charge on this next raft of war crimes and crimes against humanity, it was personal for me. And I was just like, I'm the kind of guy, like I'm an old school activist. I don't like this, whatever, man. Activism, oh God, it's just so rife with infiltrators and agents and egos and all sorts of stuff. There's good people, but there's just way too much of it. And I saw, like, people were signing petitions and people were, like, doing the protest. It was the biggest protest in the history of the world up until this latest genocide,
yes.
Right?
And I
knew, like, you're not going to stop that invasion by protesting. I knew it. And I was like, so I was in London at the time. And I remember I went to Camden Center and George Galloway was there. But then they had to open mic and everybody, whatever, if they wanted to speak, it's like, whatever, you had 2 minutes or whatever. And you know how it is at these things. Everybody goes up there and then they always like drag on too long and they're waffling. And then, okay, can you stop? Now, I'm the kind of guy, if you give me 2 minutes, I'll do it in a minute and a half and I'll bring the whole crowd to their feet. And I did. Mm. I went there and I basically called out the whole lie that all you do when you go to these protests is, oh, we're the good guys. Oh, we protested. We did our job. No, you didn't. You're paying taxes and your representatives are going to carry out this policy and they're going to kill a bunch of children and commit war crimes and torture and crimes against humanity and chemical weapons and the whole lot. And you're paying for it. So don't tell me your protest gives you a pass. No, that's the bare minimum you should be doing. But if you really want to stop the war, here's how we can do it. This is how we can do it. I came up with an idea, and I back then, indie media was the big thing. So here I am. I'm a refugee. I don't have no money. I'm just sitting here in Holland, and I decided I came up with an action plan, a call to duty, and what I said was this: none of the protests, none of the petitions are going to do a damn thing. It was decided. They're going into Iraq, I can guarantee it. But if we do want to stop it, then what we need to do is tap into something that is little discussed. The way we value life. Seems like some life is worth more than other life, eh? Well, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that, but it is the reality. It is the reality. Here we are. It's not 60,000, 80,000 in Gaza. It's hundreds of thousands that are dead now and are dying. Flat out. And if it was 1,000 white people, the whole world would be bombed over it. You know, literally. So I know that that sick, perverse, twisted reality that we all apparently just accept, which is unacceptable to me, I knew there was a way to tap into it. And here's how to tap into it. Bombing water treatment facilities is a war crime. Bombing electrical power plants is a war crime. Bombing food storage sites is a war crime. Bombing communication sites is a war crime. Why? Because according to the Geneva Conventions, those sites are critical to a protected population of non-combatant civilians. So when we go in and bomb a water treatment facility or a power plant, which you need the power to be able to pump the water, that means people have no water. That means people have no power. That means people have no light. That means people don't have any electricity. This is how the biggest numbers die, from this kind of stuff. And who's hit the hardest? The children are hit the hardest. So what I said was, because of this sick, twisted reality of the perversion of how we don't value life properly, our lives are worth more in the West. And not just West. In particular, white Western. Now, just one quick note on that. There is a white genocide. My white people are being genocided right now. So I'm not anti-white, but let's get this straight. Us white Westerners are the most valuable in terms of like why do we care so much about Charlie Kirk? Charlie Kirk, man, how many Palestinians, how many people is Israel assassinated now just openly? But it don't matter if they're Arabs or Muslims. That don't matter. Mm. But a white guy, that matters now. So my point was that if we really wanted to stop the invasion of Iraq, we need to tap into this perverse reality. And we need to get Western citizens down to Iraq. 10,000 of us, 10,000 can stop this war. And what we'll do is we'll place ourselves at water treatment facilities, electrical power plants, and so on and so forth. And I just did this and I spread it everywhere on indie media. It started getting traction. And next thing you know, people are really spreading it. And it was really like you know what? You may not like my idea because it doesn't give for an easy solution. It takes some courage. It even takes the potential for you to die if you really want to stop this war. So how many people are going to do that? A lot less than go to the protests on the weekends, I can tell you. So
yeah,
I announced it publicly. I said, like, you know, I'm going. So for at the beginning, it was just crazy me, crazy teardrop tattooed Ken O'Keefe. And so I was, you know, I was getting emails and did it. And next thing you know, I got an email from a Kiwi, a New Zealand brother. And he wrote to me and we ended up talking and he said, I'm coming with you. And I remember that moment, like one became two. Boom. Now we got synergy.
Yeah.
And more people were calling and I raised some money and I bought one black double decker bus and we got two others. That's when we're one of the infiltrators. Joe Letts, big red bus company. Joe Letts. He's an infiltrator, subversive MI6, MI5 agent. Joe Letts. Anyway, we had three double decker buses. It said human shields. It quoted Madeleine Albright, 500,000 dead children, quote, worth it. So we got media attention, and that's where the BBC Hard Talk interview came. Fox came a call in. Fox said they wanted to do two interviews, and I laughed. I said, yeah, we'll see after we do the first one. and needless to say, they didn't have me on the second time. I crushed them. I wish I had a copy of that. Totally crushed them. They were saying I was anti-American. I'm saying, you're anti-American. You are not actually telling people the truth. Your fake media is lying to the people. You're going to send American sons and daughters like me to go be cannon fodder for the Jewish state. You're the traitor. You're the anti-American. I literally said that on Fox. And they were like stunned. Like nobody else said that. And plus, I'm a Marine. How dare you? I served, you idiot. So bottom line is it caught massive traction. And we had those buses head down. And they got down there. And we had like 500 human shields at its max. I'll spare you the whole details of the story, but it literally got subverted. They had their MI6 agents on the inside, and they were working it so that this thing that I had created, that I had inspired, that I had catalyzed, the narrative became, oh, Ken O'Keefe, yeah, he's great, but he doesn't speak for all of us. So now we have to have a democratic way of doing it. And then there became these, like, you know, these gatherings where everybody had equal say. And I'm just one guy now, and I'm not the leader anymore because I don't represent everybody. I mean, Ken O'Keefe represents Ken, you know. Literally, this is what happened. And meanwhile, Saddam Hussein wasn't crazy about me either because I had said publicly that, look, the guy had committed some serious crimes and whatnot. And so I didn't get invited to the palace by Saddam. And then Saddam's guys were trying to get the human shields to actually deploy to sites that would have been legit military associated targets, which would have made the thing that I created, like, we would have become useful idiots, right? And so I was having to fight this battle with the Iraqis against my infiltrated human shields. I was in massive danger. And actually, Saddam Hussein booted me out. But we had lost a bunch of human shields. In fact, Thomas Herndahl, you know Thomas Herndahl, don't you? Thomas
Herndahl, I haven't heard of Thomas, no.
You know him. I can't believe I'm forgetting her name. Run over by the bulldozer.
Rachel Corey.
Rachel Corey.
Yeah, yeah.
Rachel died just as I was doing human shields, by the way. So I had already set my sights on
2003, God, around March, yeah.
Yes, exactly, right that time. She was part of my inspiration, by the way. And Tom Herndahl came to do the human shields, and he literally left because it was dangerous. It had become legit dangerous, and he was like, man, this is just too dangerous. I got to go, because I had become friends with Tom. He was a beautiful young Englishman. And he left and he went to Gaza. And guess what happened to Tom? He got shot in the head and died in Gaza.
Oh, hold on a second.
Thomas Herndahl.
Herndahl.
Yeah, H-U-R and DHAL.
You see, like I heard about, Tom Herndon, International Solidarity Movement. Yes, there was another Welsh guy as well, if you recall.
Really? For me, that's real activism right there. That's real right
there. Yeah.
That's where you put yourself on the line. And now we see Americans getting killed over there in the West Bank and all. Of course, nothing's being reported and whatnot.
But they wouldn't say anything. But did you tell me they actually started to bomb those places in Iraq where the group was actually present at? Oh, so did some people get killed?
Check this out. And this is just proof that we could have stopped that war. I mean, and this really was painful for me. The human shields had dissipated, but we had human shields at five or six. A power plant, a water treatment facility, a communication site, and it might have been two water plants or two electrical plants, but we had 5-6 sites. We had human shields. So shock and awe comes, and they bombed the entire country. Guess where they did not bomb? Where we had human shields.
Literally. Wow.
Literally. So those human shields that were there, I got booted out. Like, I did everything I could to avoid it, but Saddam literally sent his henchmen after me. Because I thank God I prevented them from being manipulated into sites that could have been considered legit military targets, which would have made us useful idiots, and would have been, I created the thing that literally resulted in the death of people. And this is another thing for all the people who think they want to be leaders. When you're a leader and a natural born leader and you have the abilities of a leader, what people don't realize, like, you want the glory or whatever, the responsibility of being a leader is so huge. And I knew that people could die as a result of what I had initiated. And that weighs very heavy on you. If you're a real human being and you've got a heart, I'm not driven by ego. Ego means nothing to me, man. I only care about God and his judgment of me. I love God and I only serve God, and I never cared about popularity or none of it. But those human shields who were there, or any of you who might see this, God bless you. You represent the apex of humanity, you know, at a time where the world thought the best it could do was go and protest. You put yourself in harm's way, and you made a difference to the people who had electricity and water from those power plants and from that water treatment and that food. It's because of human shield. So let that be an example to the people out there who say, oh, what can I do? We have no power. We have the power. But we need to be men and women and act as men and women.
Absolutely. And I mean, listen, I think people underestimate how effective it is. It has been effective before. It's still effective to this day. Look at the flotilla that went to Gaza. Israel also didn't target many of these people because, like you said, there's clearly a different value to lives, and this is how it works. Yeah, they'll kill a few people. The countries that they belong to will deny. Like, if they're British, you know, the British government wouldn't say a lot. If they're American, it's not really great, but we'll look into it. And that's how it goes. Then you went to the Maui Marmara. That was quite the thing at the time. And do you want to tell quickly, briefly, the story when you disarmed the IDF special unit? I think they were Sayeret Matkal, they're called, who went into the flotilla and tried to stop you from going into Gaza. What happened?
If I may just do a quick setup, I heard about the Free Gaza mission that was 2 years before. I had heard about activists who were going to sail or attempt to sail to Gaza. And of course, nobody had done this at all. And when I read about it immediately, I was like, that's awesome, man. That's my kind of activism right there. And so I wrote to them and I said, look, I'm a captain, like I'm a certified Coast Guard captain, and I love what you're doing. God bless you. And if you need any help, let me know. So they did. They contacted me. They said, yeah, we could use a captain for sure. So I ended up signing up to the Free Gaza mission. And I went to prep the boats in Greece, and literally, like, those boats weren't even seaworthy. There were serious problems. And so for 4 months, I worked on those boats, and we got them seaworthy. And I ended up captaining those two boats, and we sailed from Greece to Cyprus and then from Cyprus. And the Israelis were saying, this was in the news, you know, the Israelis were saying we were pirates and they would treat us as such and so on and so forth, and they were not going to let us in and so on and so forth. And either way, I don't really care, man. It just has to be done. And so we sailed and we made it in. We sailed in, and the Israelis were all there, and they let us get in. And so I sailed into Gaza in 2008, first time in 41 years that had been done. That, by the way, Mahmoud, that was like one of the most incredible, if not incredible, days of my life, because you know how it is in Palestine. You know how it is in Gaza. They're abandoned, not just by the world, but by their Arab and Muslim brothers and sisters. You know, they've been sitting there sucking on it for decade after decade, and everybody pays a little bit of lip service, but does nothing. And on that day, it wasn't even Arabs as much as it was, or Muslims. It was mostly non-Muslim white people from Western countries. There were Muslims there too, but it wasn't predominantly Muslims. It was predominantly non-Muslim. And on that day, when we sailed in, they couldn't believe it. They didn't think we were going to make it there. Like, they were just blown away. And the whole of Gaza, all the fishermen and all the boats, they all sailed out. All the kids were jumping in the water. They were jumping in the water all around the boat. I'm like driving the boat in, and I couldn't relax because I had like kids in the water, and like, I'm like, make sure they're not back by the stern, you know, like if you swim near that prop, man, I'm going to chop up one of these Palestinian kids. And that's no. Mm. So I'm half celebrating. Everybody else is celebrating. Vittorio Arrione, my beautiful Italian brother who was martyred a couple years later. And it was the most stunning day. It was like winning the World Cup, you know, or the Super Bowl, but it was better.
It's incomparable. It's such an achievement that is. Yeah,
it really was. And the joy that I saw on the faces of the Palestinians that day, for a moment, they had some relief, and they knew they weren't alone, and that there were people willing to risk their lives to come to them. I'm telling you, for all the people chasing material things and whatnot, you'll never know the richness of experiences I've had and all these dangerous, crazy things I've done. Everybody's built differently, but I would not do it any other way. And quite frankly, I wouldn't respect myself if I didn't do these crazy things. So that was the most beautiful day. So anyway, getting back to the Mavi Marmara, I wasn't even going to go. And actually, after we're done with this, Mahmoud, I'd like to talk to you about Aloha Palestine, because Tony Benn endorsed it. Jeremy Corbyn endorsed it. It's a plan. It was trade, not aid, to bring... I was arguing 15 years ago, 16 years ago, because I listened to the Palestinians. They said they don't want protests and they don't want aid. They want freedom of movement and the right to import and export. That's what they want.
Just to live as normal people, but they're not being allowed to live as normal people. If they were left to it, just being left to it, do you think they need support? They'll trade, they'll have businessmen, they'll have export, they'll have import, they will manufacture, they will create, they will do everything. But we have a couple of racist neo-colonialists who want to put it in the heads of the people that they're somehow incapable and need a new mandate, need Tony Blair to come and rule over them. absolutely. Feel free to share whatever you want.
But basically, it was trade, not aid. And why? Why did I come to that conclusion? Why did you come to that conclusion, Ken? Well, you know what? Because I went to Gaza and I listened to them, and that's what they told me. So I actually paid respect to the people who I wanted to go and meet. And I listened to them, and therefore I did what I knew they wanted to be done. Here we are 15 years later, and it's still always aid, humanity. By the way, Mahmoud, the thing is, I know a lot about law. Humanitarian law, as we can all see, it's absolute rubbish. It sounds pretty, but in terms of application, it's useless, totally useless. And I'm not saying abandon it, but let's be real. I'll tell you what, though. You know what's different from humanitarian law? International trade law. Why? Because business makes the world go round. And guess what? The business people have trade laws that are favorable to their making money. So it's a whole different set of laws. I had legal counsel from one of the best attorneys in London. I had backup legal counsel. I had an international human rights attorney who had signed off on it. I had Tony Benn who signed off on it. Reverend Garth Hewitts is a Christian Catholic, signed off on it. I had all these different people, including Palestinians and Western figures, who signed off on it. So I wasn't even going to go on the Mavi Marmara because I'm like, dude, I'm focused on trade, not aid. And everything is aid. And it's like, I'm sure there must be some others who figured this out. Why? Not one of these things is ever trade. A company registered in the UK or in the EU that would be operating lawful, doing international trade under the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership and all the free trade agreements that Israel is benefiting from. If a UK-based company did that, I'll let someone else take my idea, damn it. I've been trying, and if I had the money, I would keep going. I'd do it again. But the law is different. What would happen is if you sent a trade vessel and Israel did anything like it does, now you don't have a humanitarian aid issue. You've got a trade issue. The first moment that happens, you lodge to the European Commission. You immediately lodge. This is an infraction. This is a barrier to trade. It's a direct infraction on the bilateral and multilateral agreements of the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership, which has partner countries, which includes Israel, Lebanon, Syria, and the Palestinian territories, which has now reached the state of statehood. So every law that applies to Israel and its billions in trade a year applies to Palestine. And yet no one's done it. No one's done it. I tried. I tried. Here's the damn plan. Like, literally, here's Aloha Palestine right here. This is like 16 years old. You know, breaking the siege for real. For real. Like, honestly, there's the inside of it. There's the ship I wanted to get. There's pictures I took in Gaza, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I decided at the last second to go on the Mavi Marmara because it was just so big. I thought, man, okay, whatever. I wish it was trade, but whatever, I'll go. And because I had a reputation at that point, it was really cool. Like, I tried to go on this latest flotilla, and nobody would approve me. Literally.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
What, from the flotilla itself, from the organizers, or?
In their defense, I'm not exactly known for the whole kumbaya roll over, like, okay, here's, you know, I don't really like that. I don't like that. I don't know why a ship doesn't go and like some strong men and just like, whatever, if it's a suicide mission, so be it. But we're gonna defend the ship.
Yeah.
Bring it on. Like, bring your whole damn Navy. Go ahead and blow us out of the water and kill every one of us. And let's make sure everybody gets killed. Honestly, like, why are we not doing this?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sick of this whole cucked reality of boys pretending to be men and, you know, like, no. So anyway, I decided to go, and because it was really, I have to say, this was beautiful. People were trying to get on that boat, that ship, you know, like, took months to vet people and everything. And I decided to go at the last second, and immediately they approved me. They're like, yeah, you can come, Ken. So I got to the ship. And blessed again, like, they obviously knew a thing or two about my background being a Marine and all that. And when we were on the ship, they told us, by the way, just as some backstory, no knives were allowed. They were totally committed to non-lethal defense. Non-lethal. Okay. So it wasn't kumbaya, but it wasn't like I could have killed two Israeli commandos myself. Like,
because you disarmed them, and nine of them were wounded. They were brutally beaten by some of the people in the flotilla who defended themselves from them. It was an illegal attack by an illegal army of terror against a ship going legitimately to Gaza. They have no right to do that. And the people had the right to defend themselves. And then Israel ended up killing approximately 10 of them, right?
Yes.
10 Turkish.
Yes. Yes. People. And and even the beatings, I've been beaten up worse than these guys got beaten up. They weren't beaten up that bad, really. And I mean, you know, given that they were shooting and killing people. So anyway, just in all fairness, like, where guys could have perhaps like taken a metal rod and like whacked them on the head and really done damage, that wasn't done. Mm. That wasn't done. So that just shows, it's just like Hamas, you know, like, you said they raped, you said they did this. No, they didn't. And I know why. Because you're answering to God. If you truly serve God, the Hamas, the Islamic resistance, if you truly serve God, do you think God's going to give you a pass because nobody saw it and there's no prosecution in the earthly realm? Do you think God's going to give you a pass if you raped somebody or if you execute somebody who is subdued and disarmed and not a threat? No. Of course you're going to be judged. And you may end up in hell if you do such a thing. That explains why Hamas doesn't rape and doesn't do things that the Israelis do as a par for the course. Hell, they riot for the right to rape all of us goyim. So, you know, I ended up getting on that ship, and they came to me before we set off, and they said, because I had cameras and, you know, I had my MacBook Pro and all that, and they came to me and they said, look, do you want to document what's happening, or would you prefer to defend the ship? And I said, well, you know, we got media here and everything. I mean, you know, that's their job. So I'm sure I'm more valuable defending. Defense. So they put me on the defense, and I was the only white guy, and most everybody was Muslim who was a defender, if not everybody but me. I love Islam, by the way, but I'm a Christian, man. I'm holding my Christian position as a real Christian.
Fair enough. There's no compulsion in religion, Ken.
No, I know, and I'm just ashamed of the so-called Christians out there. It's Muslims who are standing up fighting the synagogue of Satan direct. Jesus would be a little bit ashamed too. Like, where's all my Christian?
I said Jesus. Every prophet would have been fighting evil, literally, wouldn't they? I think everyone who isn't taking action is shameful, and I think it should be viewed as a humanitarian thing. You know, they are your brothers and sisters in humanity, no matter where they come from. So they told you then you want to go on the defense, and you said, yes, I'm going to defend the ship.
And to be honest, I said this in the Hard Talk interview when they interviewed me later. I did not think the Israelis would be so stupid as to attack a humanitarian aid ship in international waters, delivering aid to a population in Gaza that includes 800,000 children. If you had asked me, I knew that we could get attacked. I knew that it was very possible, but I honestly felt at the time that they weren't going to do it, because I thought that the damage that they would incur from that would be such that they would calculate that, you know what, but as we know, of course, they did attack it. And I'm so honored to be there with the most primarily Muslim brothers that were defending that ship. We did it in a most honorable way when we had an opportunity to kill these murderers. We didn't. We subdued them with non-lethal means. We should, you know, and ultimately we let them go. But anyway, when I was assigned, I was put to the aft portion of the ship on the main deck, and I was put second in charge of a 6-person team. And so when the attack happened and they tried to come from the Zodiacs, like, they were throwing grappling hooks with ladders, and they weren't able to get up that way. We were easily able to repel that. But then they came with the helicopter. And now keep in mind, I'm a Marine, so I have done. Oh no, have I dropped out there? There we go. I'm a Marine, so I have done exactly what the IDF guys were doing. It's called fast roping. So what they did was they hovered over the top deck, and they sent out a rope. The rope is like this thick, right? It's a very thick rope. And they threw that first one out, and it was beautiful. I was watching from my station. I was watching this. I'm like, oh, man, that's a problem. But the brothers got that rope, the line, masterclass, and they pulled it sideways and, like, tied it off to, like, at a side angle, which meant it was useless. Like, you can't use that. So they had to release that line, that rope, and I was just like, yes. But then immediately they had a backup and they sent that one down. And then immediately the commando started fast roping down. And I saw that and I knew our area was covered. And I was just like, that's a problem. And now people are being shot. Plus, they were already shooting at us. They had snipers with guided rifles. Yeah. They were already shooting. I'd already seen people getting hit. So everybody was in danger, not least of which the guys on the top deck. And that's where I went to my team leader and I said, look, brother, we got this covered. Do you mind if I go up there? And he's like, go. And so I left my station and to go up to the top deck. And that is where when I had to go up a deck and then one more deck. And then I was right there to where I was going to get into the stairwell and be able to go up to the top deck, where now I've seen like two dead bodies. I came across one. I was like getting ready to see if I could help resuscitate him, but he had been shot right here. Contrary to
they were executing them. Yeah, they were executing them. Yeah.
But this guy was a journalist with a camera, and the sniper got him right here. And people don't know this because Hollywood, who owns Hollywood, by the way? Oh yeah, they own the media, they own Hollywood, the Federal Reserve, they own the whole damn lot. Anyway, he had been shot there, and I couldn't see the entry wound. Some guy came up to me. He's gone. And then I saw, like, oh, yeah, right. The bullet entered right there. Mm. And, you know, he had, like, you know, in the backside, he had, there you go, that's where the damage is. So he was already dead, and he was a journalist. And then I had come across another body. So I know, obviously, this is dangerous, and we've got laser dots all around and stuff. So I get up to the one level below, and that's where the first commando is pushed over the top rail, and he falls right in front of me. And that one, I immediately am able to get to his 9mm pistol. I took that off of him, and some other brothers came, and I handed them over, and they took him inside. And I had that weapon in my hands for about 5 minutes. I was like, they had said to throw it in the water, but I was like, I knew people were dead, and I knew that that weapon potentially could have been ballistically proven to be the one that killed whoever, right? So I ended up taking the bullets out of the weapon. They were real bullets, and I hid the weapon on the ship, just like hoping that we would be able to repel the attack somehow, because we were still resisting. And then I gave the bullets as evidence to some of the other people. And then that's when I went to go back up to the top deck. And when I did that, another commando, like, this is all God stuff here, man. I mean, the timing of it all and everything. And by the way, an Al Jazeera reporter actually filmed me disarming. I don't know if it was the first commando or the second one. I have his name. He's told me on record he had the videotape, but guess what? The Israelis took all that tape. Otherwise, there would be a video of me disarming one of those two commandos. So the second one got thrown over and fell over the top deck. He had a submachine gun, and he was completely alert. And I saw him come down, and I was several feet away, and I immediately started to descend on him. And he was just getting his hands on the trigger. He was literally just getting his hands right onto the gun stock and the trigger, and then the other one to hold the weapon. And I literally got to him, and I pried his hands. I grabbed his hands, and I pried them off. And I started to subdue him. And then another brother came. He had that shoulder slinged, and he was trying to get it off, but I was like, take it around his neck. And he took it around his neck, and they took that submachine gun, and I believe they threw that in the water. And that's the second one that I had. And I mounted him. I was like on top of this guy now, and he was just getting ready to kill me. So in this one case, that's that guy I actually gave a straight right. So when you look at the one who has a bruise under his left eye, that's from yours truly. That was mine. That was my little love kiss. And And but the bottom line is this, you know, I we could have killed them. We could have killed them easily, and we had reason to be angry, but nobody did. Everybody was controlled. Everybody understood that this was a humanitarian mission. Everybody knew that that even though there's reason for vengeance, and all of our Palestinian family being starved and killed, and you know, there was a lot of reason, but we all had control. We all had sight of the Creator, of God, of the Father, and you know, we did the right thing and we let them go. But it was one of the most, it's a historic event. I'm a blessed man to have been there. I wish there were more. I wish somebody would go by trade. If some billionaire wants to give me money, man, it seems like all these big influencers get big chunks of money, but nobody ever gives me any. I'm still trying to pay my damn rent.
What a fascinating story. I mean, really, so much you've gone through there. Thank you so much for your time. We definitely need to do a part two, a continuation from that. But I really, really appreciate your input, brother. Thank you so much for your time. Guys, we'll wrap it up here for this video. I hope you enjoyed this. Ken, again, brother, thank you so much for tuning in. And we will see you soon in the next show. Peace, everyone. Salam.